I'll have to get rid of that one so I don't muddle up. Okay. I'd like to thank Ron, first of all, for getting me out of a pickle with this. I had forgotten about matching window displays or whatever. I think I have a lovely title. And that was the first thing I had on the plane. And that was the only thing I had on the plane. I had lots of ideas, but I instead read a novel, thinking that it would all come and I wouldn't have to worry about it. It's been very hard over the last couple of days because there have been some wonderful talks, and I know there are more to come. And I hope that this idea will have some great currency. I know it will with at least some of you. I look to Michelle because we've already had a little talk about it. And I think it will find a sympathetic audience. We'll certainly see. The idea really is quite basic. Husserl talks about experience having or human being or being having a articulated temporal consciousness, and I want to say that it's not simply true of sound, it's not simply true of sight, it's not simply true of those other sensory experiences, it's also true of our kinesthetic experiences, that there's a present, a retentive and a protective element in the kinds of activities we learn through habit and build up into skills, but also those sorts of everyday type tasks we have, like walking, stepping up onto curbs, off curbs, reaching for a glass of water, reaching for my watch, all of these sorts of things. There is in all of those, I think, a temporal, a diachronic experience. So I'm going to argue for that. I'm going to start by I'm going to start with this. I don't usually quote Wittgenstein, because I think he's a very dangerous person to quote, because you can take him in so many different ways. But I really like this, and I think it's true of our kinesthetic engagement with the world. I will read it out, only because I think that it's... Is it legible?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, maybe I won't, I will, because it'll help me get to the spot I want to be. The aspects of things that are most important to us are hidden because of their simplicity and familiarity. And I took a little bit out there, a little parenthetical comment that was in there, out of there, and it said in that parenthetical comment, those things that are before our eyes cease to be before our eyes. They vanish. The real foundations of a man's inquiry do not strike a man at all. And I want to say that the real foundations of a man's inquiry, of a person's inquiry, an agent's inquiry, I think I could go that far because I would want to include non-human organisms, do not strike them. Those foundations are kinesthetic. They are dynamic engagement with the environment, with this reciprocal action and interaction, so that I get feedback from this world in which I'm in, and that shapes my activity in the world, and that feedback shapes my next activity and so on. And that's all through this haptic sense, which I'm absolutely delighted to have met Loz, because I don't know any other visual spatial artists, so this is very special for me. I was trying to figure out, Loz asked me a very interesting question the other day, which was how I'd come to this sort of theory, especially with only philosophy background and then some cognitive psychology training. And I really think that I came to it through doing so much horse riding and reading so much Kant. And that's Kant with a K. With a K. Not at the same time. Though I won't go into this. You won't get me. I'm going to stay on the track. And Kant talks about imagination, and he talks about a creative imagination or reproductive imagination, and he talks about a productive imagination, where we apply the categories to the given in experience and reorganize and unify it, or structure and unify it. And it occurred to me that what is missing in Kant's work, just as I think it's missing in Heidegger's work, and I think that they're both followed by Merleau-Ponty. I think Merleau-Ponty takes both of them in a way and actualizes them, embodies them. Kant doesn't think of... He says, very importantly, all my knowledge begins with experience. But we don't have any thought about the body in that text. and there's nothing about the bodily engagement. And it's that which I think is fundamental to the employment of the productive imagination and to the subsequent production of the reproductive imagination. So the conceptual imagination and the creative imagination. So I think at base, we are kinesthetic, muscularly engaged organisms or agents in our environment. And that engagement enables us to apply categories to our experience, which enables us to become creative and do marvelous things. And I've tried to argue for that elsewhere, and I'm slightly ashamed of myself because I think that it's such a good idea, but somehow I write other things, and I seem to be frightened of such a good idea. So I'm really hoping that some of this, that what I'm going to say to you, and some of what I've just said to you, you might be able to give me some good feedback about, and or bad feedback about, but I want some feedback. No, constructive, it's only going to be good. Constructive feedback, I don't want bad feedback. And I hope that from this I'll feel, yes, I should go ahead and write this. Okay, but so what I think is missing also in the aspect of things that are most important to us are hidden. What's hidden to Kant is that all our knowledge begins with experience, but what kind of experience? It's embodied experience. Mm-hmm. Now, I started to write this, and then I thought, I'm not sure if this is true. I'll make my statement, and then I'm going to qualify. With the greatest respect to my colleagues, Claire and to Russ, and I think, no, it's not the same case with Tom. What I want to do is get back to the facts. Now that sounds, I thought, that's not quite right. That isn't really what I mean. What I mean is, a lot of what you do is interpretative in terms, so it's people speaking about their experiences. But you are very much, and I've discovered this over these 3 days, 3.5 days, you are very much interested in the body and sensory experience and how that clarifies and illuminates the moment, but also the longer experience. So I think that I'm, with the greatest respect to my colleagues, I think that I'm doing something like you're doing, but not actually doing interviews. So I think that we're all interested in the body. So I was going to say I'm doing something you're not doing, but I'm not quite sure that I am. I think I'm doing something that complements what you're doing, and certainly complements what Tom's doing, and I hope Roz will find that it complements what she's doing. But we'll soon find out. Okay, this is a very long quotation, and I put it up here deliberately because Seitz wrote this wonderful article in 2000 about the thinking body, and I think at that point, that's when I started to realise that's what we need under this productive and reproductive imagination. That's what Kant needs. He needs the body. And then I started to read Merleau-Ponty. And that wasn't perhaps the best way for me to go at that time. But the simple message here, you can read all of that, but the simple message here is the one line at the bottom. I've left the rest in, even though I don't myself like it when people put up long quotations. Actually, I'll give you a moment to read through it, because I'm not talking.
Is it a bit dualistic to think of us using our bodies as if we're something separate from our bodies?
It is, and I don't want to, I don't take that line. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is one of those things on the paper that I've got a big circle.
Yeah.
Okay, I've left all of the stuff up there because you can see that there's a whole lot of motor control that's going on in this, and I follow Marchionneau in thinking that that motor control is beyond our experience. That's not something which I can get to. Perhaps it's numeral. I'm only kidding. Only kidding. Don't be out of the bait. I shouldn't have done that. Okay, but the line at the bottom is the one. The sentence at the bottom is the one I want. We do not simply inhabit our bodies. We literally use them to think with. Well, I think we live them. We inhabit them. We're not inhabiting. That's wrong. It's not an inhabiting. We are our bodies, and they are thinking things. they engage thoughtfully. Sometimes I'm not going to use that example, I'm going to stop. Okay, so our bodies are thinking things. Okay, now, my emphasis is on kinesthesia. I realize that there will be nobody here, I imagine, who doesn't know what kinesthesia is, but I'll just emphasize. It's the perception and sensation of the position of the body, its movement and muscular tensions, and we can tell a whole story about that. And really, I didn't need that slide after Ros's presentation last night. And my claim is simply that kinesthetic experience has an articulated temporal structure, just as the experience of a sound, of a melody or a sentence has an articulated temporal structure. I don't really understand why these are the two senses that are pulled out in Husserl, and the others neglected, but maybe they're the easiest to identify.
Is there any difference between that and proprioception, or is that just a different word?
Kinesthesia? Kinesthesia is, it's not, it's also to do with, proprioception I take to be some kind of homeostatic regulating system, you know, telling me where my body is and if I'm over in a tilt, or if something's moving and I'm on that thing which is moving, and it's, but my kinesthesia I take to be more than that, because it's taking me out into the world, it's bringing me out into the world, and it's not just the muscular feedback I have, it's also this visual kinesthetic or visio-muscular engagement. Would that be fair? Could you augment that?
I consider it a subset or part of proprioception.
Yeah.
These words are, you can kind of use them however you want. I don't know if there's really hard boundaries.
I think proprioception is not including the movement part.
I think so.
So the definition could be kinesthesia is proprioception plus movement.
Well, that was my first reaction, but then I thought, of course, proprioception is required in movement, but it's not the movement part, the kinesthesia is the movement part.
Proprioception is not just about muscular tension, it's nervous.
It's like balance and the vestibular ocular system.
And the nervous system.
Yeah.
And very much the internal organs.
Yeah. I used the word prehension, and this is actually Christian and I a few years ago had a talk about prehension and apprehension and so on, because we're both interested in Whitehead, Ian Whitehead, and his later philosophy, the process ontology philosophy. But prehension for me is just one of those words which, of course, we all know through being prehensile, but it's in Whitehead, it's the feeling of feeling.
So this isn't the process philosophy.
But this is it's in process and reality. He talks about prehension and apprehension, but it's not the process. This isn't the process.
It's Alfred.
A.N. She's A.N. Whitehead.
Okay,
I heard A.N. as well.
Okay, I thought there was a different Whitehead.
Uh-huh. No, it's the Whitehead. The Whitehead. Alfred North Whitehead, yes. But prehension, he describes as the feeling of feeling, the non-intellectual grasping of other actualities. Now, I like that very much because it suggests to me almost Husserl's notion of pretension. You know, when you're in one actuality, you can see that, and I'm not meaning it on a macro scale of larger affordances, but you can see the build-up of other possible actualities in your environment, like, for example, moving to the side, though that's a macro one instead of just a micro one. But there are all sorts of possibilities, moving your muscles in sideways to relieve tension, but you may not, you may do this, and you can see this often in a class or in a meeting like this, where people are sitting in certain ways, and every so often they may not be aware if they're concentrating so heavily on the talk, or whatever, they may not be aware that they're there may be a low level awareness of a discomfort and things, so they move a little bit, they shift a little bit, they shift their weight a little bit. And that's the kind of feeling of feeling. It's a non-cognitive, non-intellectual grasping of the actuality. This could be different, and it could be in a way more comfortable, but it doesn't have to be something I cognitively engage with. So it's not something which is apprehensive. I'm not self-prehending it.
Just clarity. Just, so that we've got it, because it's obviously, although it's a nice phrase, it potentially confuses because you're using the word twice in slightly different ways. Do you mean the global awareness of feeling in certain sort of ways? What's called in the field fringe consciousness? So the stuff at the focal, fringe consciousness contains things like feelings about,
yeah.
You know, but they can be very, very remote feelings about yes. what is at the center of yes. attention, like a feeling of familiarity, yes. a feeling of knowing, a feeling of things are going all right, a feeling of discomfort. Maybe. Is that what you mean?
Yes, it is. I had in mind, but I have actually taken out of that slide the phrase fringe consciousness. So maybe I ought to have put it back in. But it is, that's why I have this qualifying thing about the entity's grasping of the affective tone. I take affective tone to be an aspect of fringe consciousness. It's that...
can be. Things fringe is very...
I know, it's sure and...
as well.
Sure so. And sound. Yes, yeah, yes, I know. Oh, well, I know. Okay. Well, actually, what I was going to say in answer to your question was simply this, Matt. I take it to be, in some ways, so you can have, there can be something which can be a core feeling. It might be that you feel angry or annoyed about something, but it's not manifesting itself. But it's influencing your activities, it's influencing your behavior and your relationships with other people. And I would think of that as a kind of prehension. It's not something you are aware of, but it is still changing, it's affecting you. So it doesn't have to be simply fringe, but it can be. That's why I took fringe out of there, because of the ambiguity of the phrase, but also because I think it can also be a core feeling too, a core affection. But we can talk later on. My goodness. Go on then.
Thank you. I can accept the notion of prehension as you defined it. It mm-hmm. doesn't seem to me that it's the feeling of feeling, but if that's not a big deal, I'm happy to just let that go.
Okay, so
if by what prehension you mean is sort of an inchoate sense of all this stuff, I'm happy with that.
You know,
but if we have to go further with feeling or feeling being important, then I'd like to hear more about that.
At the moment, let's stick with it. It is. I think that it's inchoate, and I think that that's one of the difficulties we have with this kind of experience, or with any kind of experience, with the kind of experience that both Claire and you are trying to seek out, because for most people, before you interview them, and even during the first few interviews, their experience is relatively inchoate. And it's only in the interviewing practice that it becomes more coate. It becomes something which they recall, recall, not simply memorize. Is that, maybe I shouldn't get into this. Let's step back. Okay, I think one of the things that's muddied for Alfred North, Whitehead, is the notion of feeling, because Damasio, of course, has used these terms very differently. So feelings become higher level cognitive things, like as Michelle and I were talking about this morning, you can feel respect for somebody, and that can be a feeling you have towards them. But there are other sorts of emotions which are bodily, fringe, however you might want to call those, and I think that's the kind of sense, the affective sense that Whitehead had. But we've got an ambiguity that's crept in here with this notion of feeling. And so we've got to try and counterbalance that. So I mean it in that the original sense that Whitehead was using, and that's inchoate. It's that sort of affective tone. Rod?
Just to clarify, is it accessible to awareness?
Yes, it is. It's pre-reflective, yes, but it is accessible to awareness.
Never mind.
We've only got about 15 to go, so I don't mind. No, go on, Christian, you may as well. Because I know that you know Whitehead, so if there's anything you can say to elaborate on.
Clarify a little bit about how Whitehead uses prehension.
Right.
And so, but to do that, I'd like you to just say a word or two about what you mean by the second feeling there.
Feeling on the second bit.
The subjective form.
Feeling of feeling, the second feeling.
Oh, yes, yes.
Can you say what you mean by that?
So or tell us it's not that important and we can just cruise on. This was my question.
Very well. Okay.
I think it's going to take a long time to get down there.
I'll
summarize my point by just saying that for Whitehead, prehension can mean just feeling. It doesn't need to be the feeling of feeling.
Yes. Though it's the feeling of feeling that you act upon. And it doesn't have to be a reflective feeling.
Absolutely not.
It can be a pre-reflective feeling. I didn't realize that was your question, so I thought it. It can be... I think the feeling of feeling can still be an inchoate sense, but it can move you to action. The feeling by itself may not move you to action. That the body becomes, in some sense, a low-level sense. I'm not saying this is reflective consciousness. In some low-level sense, the body becomes aware of perhaps an discomfort in some memoir. You become aware of some sunlight when someone's speaking, but you're not really aware that you're looking towards the sunlight. You have a feeling of feeling in those cases. But otherwise, you can have simply a feeling. You might, if you're aware of the sunlight, move your eyes towards the sunlight, but you're only aware in that feeling of feeling, that are influencing. I wish I could move to the next slide.
Could I call that a pre-reflective feeling?
Yes, you could. Yes. In each case, I'm going to, well, you can see from here, I said the content is non-conceptual, and I think that would make one reasonably happy, and depends on perceptual, kinesthetic, proprioceptive feedback loops. So there's quite a lot going on there. I think of our touch receptors as being perceptual, obviously. I think of my visual sense as being perceptual. When I'm reaching for an object, and I'm going to give you some a little example of this later on. When I'm reaching for an object, I have a perceptual, kinesthetic, proprioceptive feedback. I'm able to judge as well that my perceptual, kinesthetic, proprioceptive feedback works, and in fact the mouse is there and I'm able to grasp it in a different kind of grasping, but we'll go on. Okay. So, in line with Varela, Roche, and Thompson, I want to say that we develop our experiential histories through, now this is also going to cause all sorts of bothers, but a plenisentient prehension. Plenisentient shouldn't cause an awful lot of bother. It's simply that I think that we are fully switched on. We are conscious in all sorts of ways which we are not being self-consciously aware of, but I'm aware at the moment of the pressure of my feet on the floor. Now once I bring them into the spotlight, I'm going to share your term, once I bring them into the spotlight of consciousness, of course, they become it becomes a reflexive consciousness and it spoils the example, but I'm aware of all sorts of things. I am aware visually, we discover this through your interviewing, that you're aware of visually. I discovered this especially today with Michelle taking me back through a moment when I was 15 and I just recalled a huge amount of one very important moment. And at that time, I was not reading Whitehead and not reading Rodney Cottle. And of course, Rodney Cottle hadn't written the book then, but he talks about plenisentience. And I didn't realize that at that time I was fully switched on to the moment. It was an exciting moment. I was riding a horse and I was aware of my muscular position. I was aware of how I'd moved slightly forward because I was coming to a jump and I was getting ready to get my balance just right. And I had slowed the horse down from a gallop across the field to get to the jump and so on. And I was aware of that and I was aware of the sound. No, I wasn't aware of sound. I was aware of sound, the horse hooves. I was aware of the colours of the trees. I was aware. It was so much. It was so rich. And that's all I mean by this plenisentient prehension. Mm-hmm. And I think it feeds back and it feeds out. So that in all our movements, in all our engagement with the world, we are asking muscular questions. When we move our eyes around in their sockets, we've got six muscles in each eye, as you all know, we are asking questions about the world. So if I'm looking over here and I'm talking in a bit of Madeline, who I actually expected to be there, I have some anticipation of Madeline being there, because last time I looked over, she was there. So I look around and I'm asking the question, is she still there? My expectation is satisfied. All of that goes on at a pre-reflective level, that muscular engagement. No, we're going to wait, because we've already had too many. I'm being firm now. And I think of this as being intentional kinesthetic activity. Not all intentional activity has to be at the level of the cognitive belief, knowledge, hoping, any of these mental state things. It can be, you know, the looking round to talk to Madeline. I have a belief that Madeline will still be there, but I'm not thinking I believe that Madeline's still there. I act in accordance with the belief, so it doesn't have to be manifest in my cognitive system. It doesn't have to be an intellectual intentionalization. So in all of my activity, well, maybe not all of it, because when I thrash about at night in bed, in a great deal of my kind of thinking activity, if in my actions, let's say that, not my movements, in my actions, I'm acting intentionally. But if somebody butts into me from behind in a supermarket with a shopping trolley, that is not intentional. It might be intentional on their part, but it's not intentional on my part as I stumble into the hands of beings. Not that that's ever happened. Hubert Dreyfus refers to this sort of situation as non-reflective, adaptive, sensitivity to context-dependent relevance. I can see why you find philosophy is a bit of a chew. I think that's a beautiful sentence. and I think that just shows what kind of... Now, I'd also like you to take heart. It's not just you who needs water when you stand at the front. You know, that you took some water the other day and said it's very in the front talking. This is this kind of, you know, and Merleau-Ponty talks about the pragmatic engagement, and Gibson talks about the affordances. When you look around your world and things have an affordance for you, things, other things don't have an affordance for you, and you make decisions all the time in nanoseconds, picoseconds, about what's going to be useful to you, what's not going to be useful to you, and what you want to turn your attention to now, and so on. And so you're continuously doing this. Now, I think that Dreyfus is really talking about that sort of activity, the non-reflective, adaptive sensitivity you have to the relevance of things within your environment, those things being for you or not for you. Max, write it down. Don't shake your head. It's terribly off-putting.
Sorry.
It's the only workshop I ever know where you can tell people that. Try not to shake your head in despair.
I'll try.
The philosopher finds advantage of the first credit research, finally.
Even you can do this.
How am I doing? I'm
okay.
I've got
everything.
Five
more minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't start. To
compensate,
I will shake my head.
Thank you. It's always good to have you on my side. Thank you. Okay. Here I'm actually going to move towards this notion of building up this. Well, actually, I think in all of the engagement I've already talked about, I think that there is a present, a retentive, and a protentive melody that's going on in the kinesthetic engagement. But here are two lovely quotations. The first one I quickly adore because it's Merleau-Ponty, and I only discovered him just after the year 2000. And had so many years I missed when I could have been reading him. But movement, he says, with its internal articulation. I think that's so lovely. Internal articulation. And as a kinetic melody, gifted with a meaning, carries within itself an imminent intelligibility. There's a melody which becomes intelligible in the action. It becomes, we realize the intention in the action. It has an imminent intelligibility. And Luria, who I believe wasn't so wonderful in many ways, but is still a great writer, talks about the initial stages of formation of any movement. He says the chain must consist of a series of isolated impulses. I'm not absolutely sure I agree with him on this, but if we, because it suggests a kind of atomism or a kind of synchronic building up of moments, but with the development of motor skills, he says, the individual impulses are synthesized into integral kinesthetic structures or kinesthetic or kinetic melodies. So it's the idea of a melody in each of these cases, which I'm trying to pull out, because, of course, melody is so prevalent in this world of work. Luria gives an example, which I think Steve's heard me give before, and I think possibly even Jack, of learning to write. And you start to write, and you write in your book, and you have a lot of concentration on the movement of the pencil and making sure that you don't go below the line if it's an A, and you go below the line if it's a G, and you come back up, you know, and it's so, there's so much attention, so much visual attention going into this, and the musculature for this is very awkward, and isn't fluid, it hasn't become a melody. But after a while, you become a little bit more confident, and they begin to learn to write. He says, when you write your signature, when you develop a signature, and it becomes flowing, and it becomes melodic, it becomes something you can do, unless the circumstances become unnatural. Where, for example, if somebody's staring at you at a checkout, and you try to sign your name, and you, suddenly it isn't. Somehow the muscle seize up, and you lose that melody. And apparently, my signature comes out as Sonia Muffland. I have no idea why, but anyway. Okay. I know that many of you know Maxine. Oh, and she sends her very best wishes to everybody, and she's sorry she can't. And what?
Bert
has been through his operation. So for those of you who know, we haven't talked, and he's good. It was in Maxine's work I discovered this the use of a phrase, the energic character. For muscular activity. And I'm pulling it in here. This energic character is this energy that moves when things have become... So if you you pick up a hammer, say, and you don't know what to do with the hammer, but you have an idea of what you want to do with the hammer, and actually you become very good at this, or you become very good at whittling shapes out of wood, but to begin with, you stab your hand, or you take the foot off the thing you're creating, you know, this sort of thing. But there's always an energic character, but she says when it becomes, when that energic character is controlled and the movements become more fluid, we end up getting a flow, a neuromuscular dynamical flow. And I think that's true in things, in learning to walk, it's true in learning to grasp things, in learning to pick up the glass, in not managing to smash it, as so many people heard me do last night. So this neuromuscular dynamical flow of engaged movement enables an active kinesthetic imagination. Now, all I mean by an active kinesthetic imagination is the expectation I might have in my engagement. So if I continue walking, I expect the feeling underneath my feet to change. Now, that's a cognitive one because I'm telling you out here, and it's become the footlights of consciousness. But I can have that feeling, that effective tone in my movement. When I'm talking to somebody, I can be walking along and talking to somebody. And it's interesting that Ian Waterman, who has lost that proprioceptive sense and that kind of internal kinesthetic fluidity, that internal kinesthetic balance, can't walk and talk. He has to concentrate on one and can't do both. And I think that leads to this capacity for kinesthetic anticipation or expectation in the way that this notion of an expectation that Ron's robots have of their environment through visual feedback. I think if they had a subtle musculature, they might also be able to have this kind of kinesthetic anticipation or expectation. I'm going to use these two examples, which I think are really rather interesting, but I also think that the first one's very funny. A student in one of my classes a few years ago suddenly patted his leg. It was quite a loud pat. It was a quiet moment, believe it or not, in one of my classes. And he did this, and then he seemed very agitated, and the people beside him seemed a little bit agitated. And he said, "I thought it was my phone, but I haven't got my phone." And he was getting phantom leg vibrations, or phantom vibrations in his leg, because he usually keeps his in the lecture when he puts his phone on, vibrate. And he had a feeling. Before that, he may have had a feeling or pre-reflective kind of thing, and then it became something he was aware of, and then he hadn't got the phone. And he said this has happened to him more than once, and I believe it's actually one of those phenomena which is quite frequent now. Mm. I think it's a very interesting situation. In a sense, the leg had learnt that this is associated with, you know, maybe a particular time of day or whatever. I'm not quite sure if that's true, but anyway, I think it's a very interesting example. And then this is something I mentioned the other day, when we were talking with Tom about it, an active torch, and this is this work of Peter Koenig at the University of Osnabrück. And he, I've checked all the details, and he has this belt that's lined with 13 vibrating pads, various modules. And what's very interesting about this, and I quite liked it, and that's why I mentioned the cell phone example, my phantom vibration, well, not mine, I suppose. Peter Koenig uses cell phone internal motor just like you're using as well. And on the outside of the belt, there is this power supply and sensor which detects the Earth's magnetic field. And wherever you're facing, so if I'm walking ahead and north is ahead, the vibrating pad here the pad here will vibrate, and I will know that I'm moving north in this direction. If I turn, the pad that will vibrate is this one. And here it is, recorded turns. And here you, okay, so on. So what you have at all times, or what you build up kinesthetically, because it's only a tactile sense which is feeding into the muscle receptors, what you have at all times is a muscular sense of where is north. Now, I know that, of course, you begin, you are aware of the juddering, or the whatever, the vibrations, and that's feeding up, and you think, oh my goodness, so north is there. But after a while, people weren't doing the cognitive thinking, oh, that's where north is. They were just acting, that's where north is. The kinesthetic activity became intentional rather than a cognitive intentional. And when the belt was taken off, people were still able to tell where north was. Which is a very curious sort of thing. They didn't. I don't know if they got phantom vibrations. I should write to Peter and ask if they got phantom vibrations as they turned. Okay.
But can you say a little bit more about...
At the end. I'm being firm now. I will. Keep a note. Okay, we all know this. I'm not going to go through this for you because you all know this stuff about sentences with Chris Earle. Is that true? Because I'd rather get onto a couple of little videos, I think, and I want to do it in time. Are you happy? I know Madeline, maybe not. Happy? Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So all I'm saying here is the sensory felt dynamics, so it's a felt dynamics of kinesthetic engagement, establishes non-cognitive bodily expectations about how the agent's world will continue to be. Thus our experience of playing an instrument, of riding a horse, of walking down an escalator, is at the same time present, retentive, and pro-tentive. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think one of the lovely things about... Well, I'll say it. Afterwards, I can give you the example that comes up. Okay. This is just an idea in a sense... Well, no, it's not. Kinesthetic engagement is perception enriched by experience and habit. Just... I'll say no. And the ways we have of experiencing things that have become customary. But this familiarity, to come back to Wittgenstein, is also the way in which felt experience becomes hidden to us. It becomes that thing which... even Kant, in his great wisdom, overlooks. And Heidegger overlooks. Although I'm assured by Tom, I think, that doesn't overlook it altogether.
What particularly?
The body.
No, well, he does pretty much.
I think he does, okay. Okay. Now, what I had up here was, well, I had thought, well, I could do something terrible to this quotation for this role, but I think what I'll do is just tell you what I was going to do. I was going to take it out of there and put in kinesthetic experience and then change sound further down to kinesthetic experience or engagement. So I'll let you read it. One of the great joys I've had over the last 6 months or so has been reading Internal Time Consciousness. The phenomenology of internal time. And if I make those changes, that's exactly what I want to say. Now let me... Have we? Claire?
Uncontextualized.
I'm afraid it is, but I felt I've been trying to give as much context as possible, but I know this out of the context of the book. But that's why I wanted to take the liberty of changing it for my own purposes, but that's easy. I can't help putting some poetry into presentations, and I think that there's nobody beats T.S. Eliot for talking about time. And I looked everywhere through as much... as I possibly had. There really isn't. And I think that's absolutely lovely because it's Husserl in a nutshell. Time present and time past are both present, perhaps present in time future and time future contained in time past. It's that kind of Husserlian paradox. Now, what I want to do, I want to do two things. What I'm going to, because I'm going to stop this, is muscular engagement with the world gone wrong. And if you see this guy at the right, it's just absolutely hideous and horrible. And I found that the other day when a band is sitting beside me. I looked for muscular engagement. This is awful.
Is that real?
Yes, it's real. Absolutely real. This man, I don't know how he walks. But anyway, it's gone wrong. This is muscular engagement with the world gone right. I wish this was my pussycat, but this is a kind of Zen pussycat. We're actually coming to a video. I just want to get rid of the slide. And this is just a little... This is my cat's paws. Well, one of my cat's paws. And that's just a thank you to you all. But I want to show a little video first. Before. So thank you very much for listening for the moment. But let me show two little clips from videos. It's a... Oh! Beautiful. It's a paws. Oh, lovely. Thank you. So let me show you these. Now... this one, let's see if I can get him back here. Am I going to be able to get him back here? I want this little one back here. I'll take it a little further. Okay, this I think is where it all begins. But actually, I think that's not true. I think where it all begins is what Steve was saying the other day about the prenatal moving in the womb. The first experiences you have are tactile experiences, they're haptic experiences. Finding the boundaries of your body, finding the limits of your body. Having a sense of this is me, ownership, I might want to call it. I'm not sure if it's ownership at that stage, because I think you only really get ownership when you get other, but we'll not think about that. Actually, yeah, that's a big statement. I want to think more about that one. But this, I think, is absolutely lovely, because whoever is in this video is carrying this little baby around, and she's touching everything. She's reaching out, and she's discovering space. She's and actually, I think they shouldn't have done this one, but that's and these lovely things which are moving, and she's trying to catch them. Books, good. Dark Merlin. Except these old time books. And I won't go through all this because... But it's beautiful, the different textures. Rose was getting us to think yesterday about different textures. Different textures, those are different expectations. I had the great joy last night of having Megan with me as we went around. Somebody, Megan, who does all the cooking, we're very lucky to have her. And I gave her various things to touch, and she was extraordinary, because my visual experience of the things she was touching made me anticipate that they would have a different texture. And her touch sensation very clearly revealed them to have the other way around. I'd got them the other way around. And as soon as she touched them and said this, I wanted to touch them to see if she was right, and she did. But anyway, I'm not going to let
that go. Is there a point about the social scaffolding of experience here? Because I'm just thinking about the same infants put in a different environment, say a natural environment. We've spent a lot of time in our culture developing objects that are easily separable visually, say, from their background, and also afford grasping. They're the right size, and they have the right kind of rigidity and everything. So you can imagine an infant in a normal household. Mm-hmm. It's got all these objects that over centuries and millennia have been, you know, the ultimate, the result of engineering things to be easily identified and graspable by us.
Yes.
And yet you put an infant in the, you put in an environment that doesn't have that social culture in the landscape. And it might not, therefore, engage in as much probing of the... Will children do that?
I think that's absolutely true. And I've looked at studies that have been related to cultural engagement, children in culture, their engagement in different cultures, engagement with the world in different cultures. And apparently, I only looked at these in relation to Heidegger's notions of historicity and how we carry with us this cultural thing and into the culture, and then we carry it on through our experience. And the study showed that in Japan and in China, there isn't the same emphasis on doing this with your child, getting them to touch things and pull things out and grasp things. But maybe, Ross, do you have more?
They are more aware of... They cultivate the awareness of space between things more than the things themselves, or at least more than we do. We go to objects, and they go to the connections and the spaces between.
That's fascinating. Do you have any study you can point me to on that? Well, thank you. Okay, I want to show you this one. This is, I'll show you this. I won't show you text, gets what he wants, because although it's good fun. This is, wrong one. Mm-hmm. I meant to have this up, but I didn't think I would have enough time to show you. Is it going to be? Okay, we'll just use this one. Doesn't matter that it's Spanish. Okay, this should take only about 50 seconds, so that's my plan. I imagine many of you know this, and I showed a few people this morning. This is Betty the Crow. She's now dead, unfortunately, but it had nothing to do with any of this. She's a Caledonian crow. Apparently, they seem to be extraordinarily intelligent in ways that other animals aren't. Other families of crows aren't, or corvids aren't. She's got a transparent tube, you can see, and she's got a piece of wire. Don't freeze on me, girl. And in this transparent tube, there's another canister, and it's got a little hook on the top of it. There's a plastic hook, and she's got a piece of wire. The piece of wire is straight, and she's got various things in her environment. She's tried repeatedly to try and get this. And this is the reason I'm showing you this is about muscular engagement, muscular investigation. She's investigated her environment, she's found the piece of wire. She's now altering it. Right? This is really, I suppose, for Christian. I wasn't going to show this one, but this, as I said, non-human animals, I think, also do this in their engagement.
And every now and then she has to stop and think about it.
Well, I can imagine a child doing that as well.
Because it was freezing.
Sorry. But now she's got this. Now she's got this piece of wire cut. And look, what wonderful success! And then I showed Steve.
That's a different one from the one you showed.
Yeah, that's a quicker one. There, I showed Steve another one.
Huh? I missed the.
You missed the denouement.
Yes, really.
She bends the wire and then just.
Now you spoiled it.
Come on, okay. So it's a straight wire before, but then she bends it, and apparently with the intention of going back and pulling the.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. But there's an even greater one, which I think I'll show you afterwards, and it's about how crows in Japan have learned not only to drop nuts onto the road so that cars run over them, it's very dangerous then to pick up the nut. What they now do is drop them on crossings.
Oh.
And they then go and wait at the side on the curb. You really would not believe this. You'd have to see this. They wait on the curb. This is extraordinary engagement in your world. And they wait on the curb and they hear. So this is visual, kinesthetic, it's everything. It's the same. Anyway, they hear the signal change from stop to go. And they walk out and they pick up all the pieces. And they walk back. Absolutely.
One of the aspects related to what Max was saying about Russ's joke is that notice how Betty doesn't just do it once and then go back and try it and
yeah.
fail and then try it again and do it. But this is the anthropomorphism, but it seems to be justified at some level. So that she applies some effort, stops.
Yeah.
Tries a different angle, applying effort. She doesn't she seems to be aware of when she has not and when she has met her goal of bending it enough.
I think
that's pretty impressive.
Because she moves around that blue box and presses against different sides and changes the shape right now. Mm-hmm. I'm thanking Ros for this because I've shown this to my students but I've forgotten about it completely. Let me see if I can get the sound up.
You want to turn on that?
That's what's happening. Is it top? Let me pause it for a second. This is a woman called Amanda Baggs. I know some people have seen it this morning. She is autistic, though, as well says, there's a complex of other symptoms, is that right? I'm not sure how they just said it. She is, her primary engagement with the world is sensory, and she seems to have built up a lot of rhythmic activities. She repeats over and over the same notes, since two notes only, but I'd be very happy if musicians can find out a few more. She rocks, she rubs things up and down, the same movements. But it's a deep sensory engagement that she has with the world. But she can also she can also use language. But I'll let you see. We'll go a little. Bit.
Thank you.
The art of this video was in my native language. Many people have assumed that when I talk about this being my language, that means that each part of the video must have a particular symbolic message within it, designed for the human mind to interpret. But my language is not about designing words or even visual symbols for people to interpret. It is about being in a constant conversation with every aspect of my environment, connecting vividly to all parts of my surroundings. In this part of the video, the water doesn't symbolize anything. I am just interacting with the water. The water interacts with me. Far from being purposeless, the way that I move is in a going response to what is around me. Ironically, the way that I move when responding to everything around me is described as being in a world of my own, whereas if I interact with a much more limited set of responses and only react to a much more limited part of my surroundings. People claim that I am opening up to true interaction with the world. They judge my existence. Awareness and personhood on which of a tiny and limited part of the world I appear to be reacting to. The way I naturally think and respond to things looks and feels so different from standard concepts or even visualization that some people do not consider it thought at all, but it is a way of thinking in its own right. However, the thinking of people like me is only taken seriously if we learn your language, no matter how we previously thought or interacted. As you heard, I can sing along to what is around me. It is only when I type something in your language that you refer to me as having communication. I smell things. I listen to things. I feel things. I taste things. I look at things. It is not enough to look and listen and taste and smell and feel. I have to do those to the right things, such as look at books, and fail to do them to the wrong things. Or else people doubt that I am a thinking being. And since their definition of thought defines their definition of personhood so ridiculously much, they doubt that I am a real person as well. I would like to honestly know how many people, if you met me on the street, would believe I was this. I find it very interesting by the way that failure to learn your language is seen as a deficit. That failure to learn my language is seen as so natural that people like me are officially described as mysterious and puzzling rather than anyone admitting that it is themselves who are confused, not autistic people or other cognitively disabled people who are inherently confusing. We are even viewed as non-communicative if we don't speak the standard language. But other people are not considered non-communicative if they are so oblivious to their own languages as to believe they don't exist. In the end, I want you to know that this has not been intended as a voyeuristic freak show where you get to look at the bizarre workings of the autistic mind. It is meant as a strong statement on the existence and value of many different kinds of thinking and interaction in a world where how close you can appear to a specific one of them determines whether you are seen as a real person, or an adult, or an intelligent person, and in a world in which those determine whether you have any right. There are people being tortured, people dying, because they are considered non-persons, because their kind of thought is so unusual as to not be considered thought of all. Only when the many shapes of personhood are recognized will justice and human rights be possible.
Okay.
Thank you.
So my real intention there, and I was so grateful this morning when Ross reminded me of Amanda, because I've talked at length with my students about this, but for me, Amanda is someone who has not become unfamiliar with the familiar. It's still, it's simplicity and readiness, is a readiness to hand. I'm going to stop there. I think that'll do. Because I think I'm probably... I'm still doing okay.
You've been very good.
Yeah. There we go.
Thank you.
Yeah. Come back, everybody. Sorry.
You frightened me to death, Martin. Not when you were asking questions, but when I said you could use my machine to do some email, I came back in and all my videos have gone. All my YouTube things I've set up.
I'm not used to a Mac. Very weak.
It's a very weak.
No, I didn't know what any of the symptoms meant, so I was trying to find it. I wasn't deliberately
trying
to find it.
Anyway.
I missed the outset of that video. Why is she using a computerized voice?
I don't think she speaks.
She's
doesn't mean she doesn't.
She can't speak? Or
I don't know. I would have to find out. But I don't think she speaks willingly. I don't. Rose, do you know any more about her?
She's in a wheelchair. I mean, I've seen her in a wheelchair, and she moves around. And she understands, she's spoken to, but I don't know about her
speaking. Mm-hmm.
What was your surname? I got it, man.
Vertex?
B-A-G-G-S?
Is it Vertex? Because she was obviously reading this.
Oh, no, it's her text. No, she's not reading it. She's typing it into the synthesized speech. Well, should we keep questions for discussion afterwards? Because we have three sessions to do today, so this afternoon?
We decided we'd really probably only try to do two.
Oh, excellent.
For this time. I'm not quite sure when we'll fit in the last session, but we'll figure it out.
Susan, can I just start? I mean, she says that's a language. Is she then trying to communicate to us through her exploration of every single aspect?
I don't think she's trying to communicate with us at all.
No, I didn't think so. But language is normally, the term language is normally used to something.
She's just... Well, Stephen, I've heard it, a little talk about it. It's only a brief talk, but... I think she's trying to communicate when she uses the voice synthesizer and text.
Yes.
And this is a very deliberate...
And making the video.
And in making the video. But what Steve mentioned to me, and I didn't know about this, is that there are many autistic communities online, or at least there are autistic communities online. And some of them are very militant about being misjudged. This, I think, is a communication with her, with other fellows online. It doesn't have to be... You don't have to meet... You don't have to have eye contact. You don't have to communicate in the conceptual language. They can post videos from the autistic community, and this got onto YouTube, and it became one of the headlines on the Washington Post the day I found it about 3-4 weeks ago. But the other thing I thought was, first of all, I said to Steve, I think this is very odd because maybe it presents a counterexample to Wittgenstein's private language argument.
Yeah.
And I thought, here's somebody Although, I mean, what I'm trying to do is not say the word, the phrase that she said, because people say I'm in a world of my own. Right. And if I say that, then if she's in a world of her own, then the private language argument, she's created a language within her own world. But she says she's not in a world of her own. So the language must be there. Her the way she's acting, the way she's rocking, the way she's listening, the way she's... Is she communicating simply with her world?
Yes. Well, only simply because she is doing that. Really.
She's communicating with the world, but it could still be a private language, so she's not necessarily communicating with others.
Well,
I would like to know what Ross.
I'd like to make a statement.
Yes, please, Steve. Yeah.
I think she's actually communicating to us. It's a bit the way music is communicating because it's something like look. I'm doing this, and someone, I would imagine someone who is autistic, who watches that who would have an affinity with her actions and maybe would do similar kinds of things and would, you know, it would be real communication to them in a very direct way, because it would be a kind of an acknowledgement of this is part of my life, is it part of your life too, kind of thing.
I agree with you. In this instance, she's trying to communicate with us. The making of the video, I think, is... But you mean even in the...
The actual action.
Okay, okay. That's what I hoped to know.
Yeah, we're trying to get to. Okay. For example, when she was clicking that bit of wire on the door handle, that, you know, kind of gave me a bit of a buzz, as I'd say, oh yeah, that's... You know,
I imagine she would also do that when no one is around.
That's the point I'm making.
Probably still call it language at that point, even though
you're communicating. Self-communication, reassurance.
I think she's communicating the world.
I think the word language is political here.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
It could be like
Yeah.
The whole, you know, in order to raise up what she's doing, she's using our word. For what we
can,
that kind of intercourse with the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just guessing.
Yeah, I mean, I think she said quite clearly, she's communicating with the world and we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand her reference to language to refer to that communication with the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She did say the water.
Yeah.
Well, she was saying that the water is mutual.
Well,
that was unbelievable. The water speaking, or
what
was interacting.
I found it very believable.
Yeah. But that's why I said that maybe she's communicating with the things around her. And you saw at one point that she has a dog in there as well, and I imagine he gets communicated with quite a lot.
He looked very bored.
Yeah, but she wasn't communicating with him at the time. I remember that communicating with the world at the time.
Good.
Okay. Just about.
Yeah. Okay, I think... One of the lessons that we can learn from, for instance, Ernest Cassirer about his study, writings about language, is that language is primarily formative.
Mm-hmm.
It is formative before it is communicative.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps us to shape our experience.
Mm-hmm.
And this is its primary role, so to say. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the response to the old question, whether a Lonely Robinson on an isolated island would need a language, from that point of view, would be a yes.
Yes, he would.
Even if he's alone, just for that purpose, to keep things in mind, so to say, in that he would be naming them, giving some
except
verbal label or
except
the shape that could be kept in mind for that.
Because you, I think, is. Paraphrasing and getting Kant sort of slightly backwards. Of course, he's a Kant scholar, and he says Kant does do in the metaphysical deduction an analysis of the structure of language, the categories, he derives the categories from that, and then he says these are the things we apply in our experience because this is the source of these are the sorts of statements we make. And so, in a sense, well, then Cassirer takes that and says, well, our language forms our world, but it's actually our cognitive system structuring or forming the world, and the language, you might want to say, although I think I'm not sure what I want to say about this, the language is formed because we form the world like that. The language comes from that. Yeah. But that's not necessarily, that's not an accounting position.
Yeah.
Right then.
Well, we don't have any trouble.
Actually, it is a accounting position.
The answer is
yes, that's true. Yes.
Sorry, what did you say? We don't have any trouble saying dance is a language.
Or music.
Yeah,
or communication.
Why couldn't her activity be?
Or when you...
Except that then we want to be careful about using the term language just as she does. And I think you're right that in this case it's a very critical term. And I really thought that more when she said about the autistic communities and how some of them have become very militant. Getting back to this anyway, no, I'll not get back to that. I'll come back to that afterwards. But.
Well, I do just say that what I got from that was that her, yeah, she used the word language quite a bit, but to me the biggest impact of watching that was her emphatic insistence that she was a thinking being,
a being
that is rich with meaning, and that her gestures are her interactive, inactive relationship with the world around her that's expressing meaning, And that's just as valid a mode of cognition as what we consider to be intellectual conceptual thought.
And I have a conception of cells. I find cells, as everyone else in this room does, very difficult to pin down. And in fact, what I tend to do is say that a self is the pronoun I, and I think that we have agency. And then we've got this agent which engages in the world, in its cultural, social, historical world. And from that comes personhood. But on the way, we tend to get language. And that language makes us, so the self becomes a linguistic entity, in a way. It becomes the subject of the pronoun. And then we try to find it, and then we have a great deal of difficulty. And I think that's where our problem lies. So it's a linguistic construction in some way. And I think if you get to that, you have this agency, but you don't get that stage where you acquire this linguistic capacity, and you don't express yourself with others socially, culturally, as I, they don't treat you as a person. And I think that's what you said.
Yeah.
Would that be?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who had their hand up first? Did you?
I think I do.
Okay.
But for those of us with a short little attention span, could you remind us how we got from the beginning of your talk to talking about language? Because at the beginning it seemed like we were talking about
Everybody was talking about language through Amanda Bagg's video.
So that's the question. How did we get from you talking about Amanda Bagg? Other than that was an interesting
book. Well, because in a sense what I think I was talking about agency and movement and the diachronic sense of muscular engagement, which I think has to be there for you to be able to create melodies, kinesthetic melodies, has to be there, I think, if you're going to participate in the kind of jam session I didn't attend it, I was with you and Steve and Ron engaged in that evening, where you anticipate both visually, because you're looking at gestures, and kinesthetically to one another, and melodically to one another, and you can anticipate the other notes and things.
It put in a phrase, I think, that what the response is, it's about being familiar with the unfamiliar. I mean, that's what you opened with, and that's what you ended with.
And what I end with, and the reason I'm just so lucky Ross mentioned it this morning, because I was thinking for the last few days, and I'm so glad on Tuesday, because I was thinking of the video, couldn't think of some way of doing this, and Amanda is exactly that agency.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't encumbered. Well, what it's encumbered with is our responses, because she's not a linguistic. She's not a linguistic agent. So what she has is all of that kinesthetic, muscular questioning, that mm-hmm. sort of engagement with the world. And we got to the notion of language simply through the general sort of conversation. And
she said she was.
She was a creature of language. And she has the most sophisticated language. So the notion that she didn't have language
that's exactly right.
That's exactly right. What she was complaining about was that people didn't see her, because she was. And we can't assume from the fact that she was moving in the way that she was, that was all she was capable of. It's clear from the lucid way that she communicated, that she developed plural concepts, she developed grammar, semantics, and all the rest. And so she's saying, look, I'm a sentient being, I act like this, I look like a stupid being, but here's all this intelligence. You haven't asked me. It's a bit like people drunk on the streets. You know, you think there's a bum or whatever, and they have rich lives. You don't know their histories. I see it more like that.
It's like Ian Waterman, for example, when he first loses his proprioceptive sense, and he is flailing around, and he goes to the hospital, and they think he's drunk. He's not drunk. He just is incapable of controlling his movements of his body because he's lost the homeostatic internal functioning system he needs to do that. And the same is happening here. And I agree with you, Max, that she's got this is a very unusual woman. This is, I don't really understand autism. I'm not going to pretend I do. And I know that there's a large spectrum of autistic disorders, and I don't know where she sits on this. But there are many autists who do not have her capacity for language. And there are many, I imagine that she doesn't spend
a capacity for our language.
Our language, I beg your pardon. Mm-hmm. I mean our language. You're quite right. But I think in her situation, she has probably spent a lifetime, I think, with that kind of primary agency, that the same kind of thing we had last night with the clay, although it was noticeable that only a few of us did this. I held the clay up to my face, I was feeling it and experiencing it, I wanted to feel the textures of it, I held it up to my nose, I was smelling it, I bit into it. You know, I actually wanted to drape it over my head to feel how heavy it would be and if it pushed my spine down, but I didn't do it because I thought I'd end up with clay on my hair and then it will take the blindfolds off and you'll all wonder what the hell she's been doing with the clay. And I was talking. But the whole point of that was, I think that my, and the same with Jack, his engagement was trying to find its weight and putting it up here, and I think that seems to be primary still in this case. And that's all I was saying with Amanda. But I think she's very unusual. And Ross tells me this morning that she's in fact being...
She's working at MIT.
With
people are working with her.
People are working with her. She's not working at MIT.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
she
could be.
Michelle! Michelle, we'll wait till the house. I'm sorry, I see by no one. I'll come back. You don't have... Thank you.
Very good, Michelle. I think I interrupted Russ talking with you, and I'm not sure that you finished.
I'm happy to go to Michelle.
I think the theme of becoming unfamiliar with the familiar due to the destroying effect of habit is really fundamental to our understanding of every problem of theory of knowledge. So I'm very grateful to you that you raised this issue. And I think there are many authors who pointed out this precise problem and who are also forgotten, so to speak. For instance, there are parts of Jung which should be more known than they are, in fact, in which he says, for instance, that our use of concepts like the concept of substance is due to carelessness and inattention.
Yes, yes.
You know that?
Yes,
carelessness,
I do, yes.
And inattention, yes. to the most immediate familiar variety of sensations. Instead, when I say, for instance, this glass that I see here now is the same glass that I saw yesterday, I'm just ignoring a lot of variation in light, in reflections,
yes.
And so on and
yes.
So on. What does it mean to be the same? The same means that I believe there is a history which
mm-hmm.
connects
yes.
the glass here and now and the glass
mm-hmm.
yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So this is for the theory of knowledge. I think it solves many of the problems.
I know, with Maxine.
Yeah. secondly.
We're not going to be alone with you in future. We're going to be together.
Yeah. Secondly.
Really proud.
Secondly, it's not only a problem of theory of knowledge. It's also the basis of I think, spiritual inquiry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you know, there is a beautiful metaphor in Indian, I think it's a text of the Vedanta, in which the author says that in ordinary life, we are like a person who is holding a chariot, going very fast, and not seeing the pieces of grass. The world.
Yes,
blades of grass, exactly.
Yes.
And when we stop finally, namely when we see the detail, the exquisite details of the blades of grass,
yes.
Finally. So I think, and we become again familiar with the familiar.
So I could have had the same sort of arc in my presentation that you did and come round to the spiritual.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought of that at all, Michelle. I'd like to talk more with you about how I can think about that. It's interesting, again, last night with Megan, she said she's very familiar. Anything I took her to, she could recognise immediately. She said she's lived here too long. And maybe that's true. But I took her to one of the vases with some grasses and things in, and she was touching these, which I was looking at, and she said, these have got, the little petals have an oval shape. And my visual sense, even looking not too closely but closely, couldn't give me that. And then when I was about to take her somewhere else, I said, hang on a second. And they did. If you closed your eyes, they had an oval shape. And so I was, because I was looking and not experiencing, not, they were, it was unfamiliar to me just by looking at it. Became familiar with touching my eyes. Max is still shaking his head. He's keeping.
Steve,
I know you know. Oh, do you want to add something to that, Ross? Because it was in your session. No. Okay.
I did want to say something about Amanda, but I'll tell you later. Other than, I just wanted to say that I thought that Ross's thing yesterday, the first one, the one that you just discussed, was very much about trying to get us to be like Amanda.
I don't know whether you think that's fair, but that's also how I, and that was why I mentioned Megan again with this, because somehow if you closed your eyes and stopped making the presuppositions you always make, if you stop doing that, there's a simplicity and familiarity, and that's slowing down that chariot.
But can I...
It's interesting, Plato also has the chariot, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I didn't want to say, but can I now say what I did want to say?
That was what you didn't want to say.
Yeah. So what I really wanted to say is this. There was something, I wanted to get back to the pulling away the essence of your talk.
Yes, please.
And actually to articulate a puzzle that I have that... In relation to what both Russ and Claire are doing, and something that came out of the conversation I was having with Urban, well, as part of the last exercise in Claire's. And the puzzle that goes something like this, and also when Russ was debriefing yesterday with the youth, and the puzzle is this: we're not supposed to bring our knowledge in. But what you were doing when we're describing these experiences in these kinds of interviews, both of you, I think, for different reasons, maybe not for the same reasons, want to say it's the experience itself, and that the knowledge is kind of is part of the context. Or shows maybe confabulation or something. But when you describe the kind of, I can't remember the title of your talk, but you were saying this is something very important about kinesthetic experience. If you were really talking about what experience was, then it should be possible for us to describe our particular experiences in those terms.
I think that we almost...
So my puzzle is, are Russ and Claire wrong?
No.
Or if not, is it that any theorization like this must be only, must have a distortion built into it because it cannot get at the real experience, because when we try and describe the specificity of experience, applying these kind of categories, these theoretical categories to it, somehow must be a distortion of the specificity of the experience. But I can't quite get my head around that.
I do understand what you mean, and in fact it's a conversation that you and I had had outside as well, because I said that in trying to describe the experience, I feel that you distort the experience.
Well,
and
it's slightly different from that point, because I was saying, I'm not saying that describing the experience in just the terms that Claire and Russ want us to is a distortion, but I'm saying that describing them in these sorts of terms, if it's a distortion because it's for the reasons they say, then what job is this kind of philosophizing or theorizing about the experience doing? I'm not denying that it's doing a job and doing a good job, but I want to know how it fits in with the description, the descriptions of the experience.
Well, let me say a little thing first. I think your question is a very good one, and I myself worry about this at night, not every night, but some nights. I think that's probably one of the reasons why I haven't written this up. What job is going on here? Partly, I think. Well, let me say,
this is much
let me just, shush, because we have to stop so that Urban can start 3:30, so we get Urban.
Actually, It's calm. But anyway.
Have you got another stay of execution?
Yes. Please go ahead and finish your work. We should finish up in 10 minutes. I have a question actually I want to ask you. So.
Well, I'm just.
Yes.
Come. I think that what I had interpreted in a way as a distortion by the verbal report isn't necessarily true, because it's not the content but the structure of the experience which is being investigated. I think I'm right in that. Is that fair?
Well, I would say in a different way, and I have a few things to say in answer to your question, but I'm not sure that I should say it on your nickel.
Not when my nickel's quickly becoming cents. But perhaps we can talk about that afterwards. But I think the other problem is a really big one, and it's one I think which we've had an email communication for a couple of years about this. And in fact, what good is any kind of theory doing? Is that the sort of question?
Yes, but it's also a questioning what are they doing if it doesn't enable, if the theorizations aren't allowed, as it were, within the descriptions of the particular experiences. So I'm not prejudging.
I'm going to tell you absolutely the truth, Steve. I'm not sure I can answer this question without sitting down with all of you and thinking, what really is at issue here? I think I have to be honest and not make some walking response. I don't think I can do it.
So the way it seems to me is that there isn't anything that is pure experience that I'm able to get at. Maybe a very adept meditator can get at it. I don't know anything about that. So so the way I conceptualize it is there's like a cone here, where down there is where experience really is, and my method sort of oscillates back down here somewhere, fairly close to it, but not right at it. So when I say I'm interested in inner experience, I mean that in a manner of speaking which is a little bit loose. It's way not as loose as a lot of people mean when they say they're interested in experience. It's actually a pretty darn close definition of what it is, but it is by no means actual experience that I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
And the philosophical positions are farther up the cone, seems to me, or maybe pointing down, maybe pointing in a different dimension. I'm not really sure about that. I haven't been able to figure that out. But they're not basically at the same stop on the elevator. So maybe there's an elevator that rides down this cone. I get off at this stop, Claire gets off at this stop, somebody else gets off at some other stop. But none of us, or with the possible exception of really adept meditators, think about it.
Okay, and I would like to ask for all of that. So I think I've got this. Last night we did a couple of draws where we were bracketing off, in a sense, the visual sense and the visual presuppositions. So the visual sense was our set of visual presuppositions. And I think what I'm saying in this, and what I hope to say in this, if what I'd like to know whether is whether you think it's worth writing up in a way, but I don't want that to the judgment, I would like to hear what people have to say individually. What I'm saying in this is, we have to bracket off the familiar. And I don't think, we have to come back to the body and realise the kinesthetic, that the kinesthetic engagement is primary, and that it is diachronic, and that it has to be, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to build up skills. And I think that plays a very good role in philosophy, but that's partly because I see the analytic philosophy school that I was once very much in as not being sufficient. It's not doing any work. And what I'm trying to do is get back out into this community. And one of the reasons I love coming here and meeting with everybody here is because there are sympathetic voices there. You can see that there are some philosophers who are trying very hard. They may be getting some terms wrong, and they may be making some people, like Max's head shake a lot. But I think anything I say will make matters change. But we're doing something. I think it's a good sign as well. I do.
No, I would like to ask a question, but can we let Claire comment, because we're right in the middle of her domain?
Oh yes, I'm sorry, but I don't understand everything. But I guess that the question is about the relationship between this and how our lives work. So for me. Your work is about experiential categories.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the schema that I showed?
Yes.
There is experience, and from experience we describe experience, it's a second level, and from the descriptions, from a lot of descriptions, it's possible to extract experiential categories.
Yes.
So for me, you are describing experience, your job is at the level of experiential categories related with the pre-reflected kinesthetic dimension of experience.
Yes, yes.
And I have extracted very similar categories from this
principle. Right.
And so I think you, maybe you, using a less intuitive and less methodology,
less empirical.
Less empirical, yeah. Yes. Method, you have identified some categories, and in fact, they fit rather well with.
I'm very pleased.
So, this relationship could be made more systematic. Systematically,
yes.
It would be interesting.
Well, that would please me very much because, as I say, in that first little, second slide, third slide, I had, with great respect to my colleagues, and then I realized that I wasn't doing something or suggesting something you weren't examining and doing. And so I'm very, very pleased to hear that, Claire. Thank you.
So I would like to ask a question and get your response, but I really feel we need to put
Jeff, we can go to 5:45. Don't be so horrible.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, let's just see where this goes.
Oh, stop.
Let's just see where this goes. You say, one of the things you said, this is kind of a separate point from what we've been discussing,
okay.
Is that there is this kinesthetic dimension that we always have pre-reflective access to.
Yes.
And
I'm going to say yes.
And I don't agree. We've had that discussion sometimes.
Yes, we have. Yes.
As much as I'd like to agree, because I know a lot of people here are really interested in the embodied dimension, and I'm interested in it too, but as much as I'd like to agree, I don't agree. So I don't want to argue that point right now,
right.
But I'd like to know on what basis you say it. Is it a theoretical basis, or is it from... I mean, it's certainly true that we sometimes can get greater access to kinesthetic information than we thought we had, and you can come up with a lot of examples. But I also think that it's true that sometimes we're just not involved kinesthetically, and our whole world is at that moment, and this kind of has to do with the fact that I think, our sense of what's real is constantly shifting, and some of the time it just has no, or perhaps virtually no, kinesthetic dimension. So I'm wondering on what basis you say that it does.
Okay.
Is that what you're saying? That's what she's saying. All the time?
No, not all the time. I don't think that...
The rock bottom of everything is exactly what you're saying.
It's kinesthetic. Yes, it is. The rock bottom of everything is kinesthetic experience.
It's all derivative. Yeah, that's right.
Though that would include, as Christian pointed out, visceral sensations, all of that. And partly that's based on a very extensive reading of Damasio and the sense of the bodily emotions. So emotions in obviously a non-cognitive sense, and they're building up into feelings, though he seems to use feeling in a cognitive sense, and I think we've got a bit of a problem there. But it's, so I think that, so although I have part of my, it's a sort of, I'll call it a rational intuition, part of it, a sort of intellectual sense that I thought, this is certainly a very appealing and I think feasible account. Then I looked at Damasio and I looked at Daniel Stern's work and looked at various other people, and I haven't put them all up in here because I think this project of mine has become too big for a paper, and I just don't know what to do with it. But so it's not just based on a theoretical impulse, it's based on looking at other people's work, and I think at the moment I'm only just going to really, really mention Damasio and this proto-self, which becomes a kind of core self, core consciousness.
But then, in fact, when I realize she's got data, I don't know Damasio's work very well, but in fact, it's not based on your theoretical work, but it's based on his theoretical work.
It seems well, it's empirical
data that supports
work.
That. Well, yeah,
well,
but
it's empirical
every,
work.
You know, but empirical
it's also,
work,
well, okay, yeah. It's also, it's not just his. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people I've been reading, including people like Sykes, including people like Jonathan Cole, and I mean, there's there are, I don't know how many we have to go into.
Yeah.
But I'm also interested.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, thanks. That's completely different. Yeah.
No, but he's one of the people who's influenced part of what I've come to here, but it's not. It doesn't have to be his view, but it can influence. I better not go there, because I was going to go towards Samuel Beckett, and maybe that's the best thing not to do at this point.
If you substitute the word embodied
yes.
for kinesthetic, then...
Isn't you all the job?
Then, well, depends.
Okay.
That's another conversation.
Okay.
But if you do that, then the answer to your question is Whitehead, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. There's a very coherent response to your question.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm very fond of Whitehead. And I've got Whitehead and all sorts of things. We're never going to meet. We're both things. Do you like Whitehead?
Oh, no, you're misinterpreting my love.
Oh, okay.
I've been asked to contribute to chapter 2, great confirmation of Whitehead.
You know. Have you?
Yeah, but I reluctantly.
Okay, okay. Michelle, well, just Michelle can
okay,
come
Yeah, Michelle, and then we'll take a
cup of coffee.
We'll take a place.
Michelle, please.
An additional quotation, because you listed several good authors who dealt with kinesthetic the kinesthetic root of knowledge, so to speak. And I think you should also read Alain Berthaud, who is our neurologist of the Collège de France, and who is very much committed in that stuff, and I think it's quite good. Well, I mean...
I shall read it.
There is a connection between neurology and the phenomenology through Jean-Luc Petit.
Yes.
The book is worthy. I don't know if it's perfect. Of course it's not. But
I shall be very pleased to get some references, and I'm very grateful.
Yes.
I don't say that there isn't motor control which is completely inaccessible. I think there is motor control which is completely inaccessible, but we'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay.
Before we go, are we going to